This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Tom Davis. Tom's the former congressman from the 11th District here in Virginia. He was my congressman throughout my life in Northern Virginia, and he is currently the Director of Federal Government Affairs at Deloitte & Touche LLP. Tom, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm looking forward to this discussion, talk a little bit about the election, and maybe talk a bit about procurement, one of your favorite topics as well. I know you love election politics, but I know you love procurement too. But so let's start with the election first. And I just want to open it up and give you an opportunity to talk about what you see, what are the big trends out of the election. It surprised me a little bit, the margin, and I expected a late night, and I saw Ohio called, and I went to bed. So,
Well, unfortunately, that's what our system is, not popular vote. It's by state, so it's electoral votes. And a lot of these states have just settled into patterns in terms of how they vote. So there are a handful of states that are in any given election now that are really on the bubble, that are competitive. That's where the presidential campaign was. If you lived in Ohio or Virginia or Florida, you were bombarded with TV ads. But if you're in Wyoming or in Maine, you got nothing. You didn't know there was a presidential election. And that is the result of the Electoral College and what we've come down to. You've got limited resources, and so they put them into the states where it matters on the electoral count. The voter turnout was actually down from 4 years ago, but it was up in the states that counted.
Right. I think I saw something where Romney ended up with about 2 million less votes than McCain, something like that. I think it was.
Romney underpolled. Well, we don't have everything in yet. They're still counting absentees in Washington State and Florida and stuff, but it looks like he'll be under. Of course, the president's well under the numbers he had 4 years ago, too.
Yeah, well, I wanted to get your thoughts. I know one of the things that's been talked a lot in the aftermath of the election is the Latino vote, and it's becoming a bigger and bigger percentage of the electorate. And yeah, I think President Obama got 67% of the Latino vote last time, or two-thirds, I think. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but this time he received 71%.
Well, these are exit surveys. I mean, these are exit surveys. They're approximations. Those same exit polls showed, frankly, the Democrats getting even a higher percentage among Asians than they did among Latinos. So you could look at this and analyze this race till the cows come home. Let me make a couple comments.
Sure.
So the president comes back to Washington, thinks he has a mandate. The reality, he went from 53% to 4 years ago to 50% this time, but he won and won a significant margin in the Electoral College and can claim a mandate. Harry Reid had 23 Democratic seats up to only 10 Republican seats up. At the beginning of the cycle, I think most pundits at least thought the Republicans had a pretty good chance of taking the Senate. Republicans actually lost two additional seats in the Senate net. So Reid can claim a mandate over there in the Senate. And in the House of Representatives, the Republicans lost just a few seats, but they still have very operational control of the House. In fact, if anything, the House Republican caucus got more conservative because several of the members that lost were moderate members from more swing districts. So Speaker Boehner can claim a mandate. So when the president walks into the office and says, I've got a mandate, Mr. Speaker, the Speaker says, well, I have a mandate too. And we're back to where we've been the last 2 years. With everybody feeling a little bit emboldened as a result of this election. And these are the same players that have put us on a continuing resolution till the end of March that couldn't resolve the fiscal cliff issues before, that came up with the sequestering. And now they've got about 6 weeks to scramble before the new Congress comes in and their hands are strengthened. So to put this in perspective, the results are basically status quo. We've got the same players and the same problems.
And, okay, given your observations that they all could claim a mandate and, you know, and we are
not
going.
Not good. They do. They are claiming mandate.
Yeah, okay. They are claiming mandate.
Nobody's
okay.
going to push anybody around at this point.
Yeah, so so I'll ask you that question. Where do we go from here in terms of how do we address the fiscal cliff issues? Is it going to be put off until the new Congress? Are they going to do a?
Well, they're not going to just. I don't look. You have a number of issues right off the bat that they've got to face. One is this alternative minimum tax. If they don't solve that by the end of the year, it's going to get. You know, you're going to have a lot of people paying higher taxes at the lower income levels going into next year. Democrats badly want this. This hits probably people in the Northeast and blue states a little harder than red states. Traditionally, they have extended this on a year-to-year basis without finding offsets. But the Republicans want some things, too. And so there's going to be some trade-offs. I don't think they'll just let this lie because the effects on the economy and, more importantly, on middle-income taxpayers would be significant. The Republicans are pretty clear that they don't want the rates lowered, raised on anybody. Not higher income, not lower income, just a little factoid. The top 3% of taxpayers pay 80% of income tax by those 3%. And the feeling is a lot of these higher income taxpayers are actually businesses who file as individuals. And so it is a tax on small business. 50% of small business jobs are filed under individual tax returns. So if that gives you a percent that it's not as easy as you're socking to a bunch of rich people that can't afford it, there are economic ramifications. And by the way, of all of the taxes, it's about a $400 billion a year if you were to allow the rates to go back up under the current law. If you allow them to go up just for the rich, it's still a $320 billion a year the hit would be to the deficit, because it's a small piece of it that the in terms of this rate structure that the wealthier taxpayers would pay. So it becomes a little more complicated. The difficulty is getting people across the table and having a kind of an in-camera discussion over how are we going to solve this. Everything gets put out in the news, and everybody has to go back to their corner and back to their constituencies, and it's really no way to negotiate. And I just would recommend Woodward's book, The Price of Politics, which shows how the budget talks blew up last year between the president and Harry Reid and John Boehner.
Well, in that mind, you recommend that book, and how would you see this working out, or how they ought to resolve it? Is it, and obviously it's got to. To me, there's got to be some sort of compromise across the board.
Well, look, this starts with the president. He can't outsource this to Congress the way that he did health care, the way that he did the stimulus. He's got to show leadership here, and he's going to have to move off his position somewhat. Now, House Republicans are going to have to move off, too. That's the only way you get a deal. You can't make this a my way or the highway. But I think it's got to start with the president. He's not running again. He can abandon some of his statements, but he needs a deal. Letting this thing go off the cliff is letting the genie out of the bottle, and it's harder to get it back in once that has happened, because you have you start withholding taxes immediately, which cuts the purchasing power of Americans. That would cut in right away. If the stimulus, the sequestering kicks in right away, that's going to have economic ramifications. If all of this stuff were to go unresolved by the end of the year, it's a 4% hit to GDP. At a time when we're growing about 2%. So that puts you,
back in a recession,
statistically right into a recession. And then trying to put the genie back in the bottle then becomes very, very difficult. Now, there are some people, Patty Murray, who the Democratic Senate campaign chairman, says maybe it's not a bad idea to go on the cliff. Maybe that will, we go off the cliff, but we'll see how serious this is, and everybody will come off their positions and we can get something done. And there's more and more talk about that. Let's let all the tax cuts expire. They will come back and put up. So anything is possible as we go into these negotiations. I don't think the leaders want that result, but they also don't want a bad result by caving in on some of these issues that are very, very important to them. So it's going to be exciting 6 weeks to watch at this point.
Right. And is this partly, I've heard people talk about, that now we're into also sort of legacy with the president and where we go from then, how to solve this, so there's incentives in that from that perspective?
So, Roger, let me give you a perspective. I keep hearing a lot of discussion about, well, what the Democrats are going to say, you're not going to hold up the tax cuts for the middle class by holding out for tax cuts for the wealthy, are you? That's a losing argument. Well, I've been in a lot of losing arguments, and I've been in the House for 7 terms, and I was in the leadership for 4 of those years. And I can tell you that 2 years is an eternity. And the price that Republicans pay by, if you will, caving and giving up on that issue over the long term is a higher price than by taking a hit over the short term and making up like you're holding up everybody's tax cuts. Over 2 years, a lot can happen. Memories fade. But your base never forgets. And it creates havoc in terms of primaries. It creates havoc in terms of getting people rallied for the midterms. Right now, the 2014 campaign has already begun. The day after the 2012 election, you know that Republican and Democratic operatives were sitting down in their respective headquarters, taking a look at members who, in their new congressional districts, underperformed. Who's going to be vulnerable? Taking a look at the Senate seats that will be up in 2014. How do we target this? And the leaders are trying to say, what actions do we have to take now to strengthen our position for 2014? And for the Republicans to come out with a deal that appears to make them a loser and getting ruled by the president is not going to help them in that regard. So this is going to take, I think, on the part of the president. He's going to have to put his mind in the mind of some of the Republicans, understand what's important to them, and try to come up with something that makes sense. You can't do this in a public manner because you have too many interest groups in the mix. But this is incumbent. The president's the one who has to make this thing work. I think the makings of a deal are there, but the Republicans are going to have to, make some compromises as well. This isn't a one-way street by any means. But for the short term, I think they will agree on some short-term fixes and offsets, be they revenue increases, not rate increases, but some kind of revenue increases and some kind of budget cuts to avoid the sequestering kicking in on January 2nd and try to move that down 3 months or 6 months. It would be best if you could move everything to the end of March, where you have the CR coming back up for renewal, where you'll be having a vote on the debt ceiling, where you can do the tax cuts. Try to defer everything until that time and try to get a larger deal. But you're not going to get a large deal in 6 weeks. It wouldn't be a very good deal either. It's just too complicated.
Yeah, right. So, and Tom, we do have to take a break right now. But when we come back, we'll be talking more to Tom Davis, former congressman from the 11th District in Virginia and currently director of federal government affairs at Deloitte & Touche, LLP. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today my guest is Tom Davis, former congressman from the 11th District in Virginia and currently director of federal government affairs at Deloitte & Touche, LLP. And Tom, you were talking about, when we took the break, you were talking about, the budget and the fiscal cliff and how the deal needs to be worked to the extent, they're going to talk and do that. I want to turn back to some of the election mechanics a little bit and get your take on sort of what happened and why it happened. And, I'm interested in Virginia. It used to be solidly Republican at the presidential level. It's, now Obama's won it twice at the last two presidential elections. Why that happened. So go ahead.
Well, let me start with Virginia. The Virginia turnout model gets really skewed when you have Barack Obama on the Democratic ticket. He is a charismatic leader, and he rallies what I would call the minority voters in the state in a significant way, African-American voters, Hispanic voters. The turnout model with President Obama on the ticket is just skewed from what it would normally be and what we see in off-year elections and what we've seen in different presidential elections. The president strengthened Northern Virginia. He carried Northern Virginia, if you call Prince William Loudoun on in, like 187,000 vote margin. Now, it was 233,000 votes the last time. So Republicans made some inroads into where they were 4 years ago, but the president has such a large margin in the state. 4 years ago, he could afford to lose some of that. So Republicans still lost the state by over 100,000 votes, losing it in Northern Virginia. Republicans have got to figure a way to be competitive in Northern Virginia. The state party has traditionally ignored this. As they're running statewide candidates, they ignore Northern Virginia. They've even gone to conventions now for nominations to try to limit Northern Virginia's strength in the party nomination process. They don't recognize the diversity of Northern Virginia, the fact that they're not running women candidates statewide, not running ethnic candidates statewide. And that is just a recipe for a loss as you take a look at over the long, long term. And that's one of the reasons they're having some troubles. Now, they won the governor's race 3 years ago with Bob McDonald.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't nominate the Democrat he ran against was a rural Democrat. He had no cultural affinity to Northern Virginia and allowed McDonald, who grew up here and represented Virginia Beach, an urban area, to kind of reverse that. The other thing is in Virginia, we use these gubernatorial elections to send a message to Washington as much as we do elect a governor. So for the last 9 gubernatorial elections, going back to John Dalton's victory in 1977, what we have seen is whoever's in the White House, their party loses the governorship the next year. 9 straight elections that's happened. Now Obama's in the White House. Now that's not an automatic for the Republicans this time, but it does give you an historical view that Virginians factor in national issues and antipathy toward Washington and sending a message to Washington into their gubernatorial vote. But nothing is certain, and of course there is discussion about Mark Warner leaving the Senate and coming back and running for governor. He is at this point the most formidable figure in the state for the Democrats and would be very difficult to defeat if he were to declare for governor.
Yeah, with regard to Tim Kaine and Obama, did they help each other? Did one, you know, did Kaine benefit from Obama's?
Well, Obama was the driving factor in the Democratic turnout. And Romney for the, and I could say this, Obama was also the dominating factor in the Republican turnout.
Right.
Because it was
yes.
largely an anti vote, a referendum on the Obama administration. You know, Allen and Kaine were kind of along for the ride, but Kaine on a pretty consistent basis throughout the state, overperformed Allen and ran just ahead. Allen ran behind the Republican ticket everywhere.
Yeah.
Kaine running slightly ahead of the ticket, and it's one of these things where there were some Romney-Kaine crossover voters. Kaine has a moderate demeanor. He was mayor of Richmond in the Richmond area. He ran very, very well. George Allen was down to 52% of the vote in Chesterfield County, one of the most Republican counties in the state of the Richmond ambit. And here in Northern Virginia, Allen has never run up here, except for his first gubernatorial run. But his Senate races, it's always been a little tougher for him up here, and it was again this time.
Yeah. Looking nationally, I know when we, you know, in the first segment, you talked about it being in, as every, you know, the issue boils down to a few states, you know, North Carolina, Ohio, Virginia, Florida. Can you talk a little bit about what, you know, if there are bigger picture trends with regard to the national election?
Well, yeah, let me say that the Democrats have a coalition now. It's a kind of a collection of different interest groups or different demographic groups. They pull very well among young people. They pull extremely well among African Americans. They're pulling very well among Hispanics. They're pulling well among Asians. They do very, very well among single women. They do very well among the gay population. They have a group of constituency groups that may not all fit in the same room and think the same way, but they identify either with the Democratic Party or against the Republican Party. And even at a time when unemployment was hovering around 8% for a sustained period of time, which would usually knock out most incumbents, the president was able to hold this coalition together, and the economy did not affect their voting in a significant way. I would go so far as to say, had unemployment been around 5%, that the president would not have seen the hemorrhaging even among those groups and could have come in handily. He's got a coalition that is a sustainable coalition over the long term because Hispanics and young people in particular are the fastest growing groups in the electorate. The Republican base, on the other hand, has been basically male. It's been white. It's been rural. These are voter groups that are not getting larger. They're getting smaller. And as you take a look at the future, 4, 8, 10 years down the road, the Republicans are going to have to add, in my judgment, other pieces to that coalition to be able to sustain a majority and to stay competitive. They were lucky this time. It was a close race. It was a 50-48 race. They were lucky in the sense that the economy was really bad, and the Obama administration had had some bad outcomes in terms of their economic policies and were being held accountable for that. And that held their vote down, and it limited where they were 4 years ago. But over the long term, if you take a look at this from 30,000 feet, and you look and you just say, gee, where in the Republican coalition are we going to be able to put together a majority? In off-year elections, if minorities and poor people don't come out to vote, Republicans can still be competitive over the short term. But the long-term trend here is not good for them unless they can make some inroads into some of these other groups.
And how would you see them going about doing that?
Well, there are 100 ways to do it, of which the Republicans are doing about none of them. One is just showing up. I always believe just showing up makes a huge difference. For example, Republicans tend to be more socially conservative than Democrats on average. Hispanics, African Americans, are very socially conservative. If you take a look at that marriage referendum in Maryland, African Americans voted it down. It passed because of the white votes in Montgomery County. But those folks are not voting Republican. They're still voting race and civil rights, and rewarding the Democratic Party for inroads there and to some extent punishing the Republicans. Hispanics tend to be very, very patriotic, many of them are gun owners, socially conservative as well,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they're not voting with the Republicans on those issues because they can't get past the immigration issue. They're still voting immigration. So the Republicans don't pick up those people, and they're losing white voters on social issues, but they're not picking up some of the minorities that agree with them on that. If you get into an economic coalition, you think that's where the Republican Party ought to be. You're getting a lot of affluent people that agree with the Republicans on a lot of the economic issues, but they don't agree with them on social policy and are voting against them because of that. And Republicans are getting kind of the worst of all worlds right now. And so this is as good as it gets with an 8% unemployment
right,
record for the Republicans. I mean, they've got a pretty good narrative at this point that we can govern better. Democrats have done, and they couldn't win with that. So, it's not time to panic. This is not the Goldwater election where Republicans didn't control anything, only had a third of the Senate, and really not an easy path back. But it is time when you take a look at the long term to say, geez, we got to start making this a game of addition, not a game of subtraction.
Right. A game of subtraction leads to loss.
Yeah,
permanent loss. Yeah, exactly. And that sort of is interesting, too. I thought I might ask you, that I think the Republicans now control 30 governors.
They picked up an additional governor's seat this time, so I think it's about right, 30 of the 50 governors.
And how does that, that's kind of interesting your point about not a national election, a more local election. You're not having, a presidential election. Does that reflect, part of the Republicans?
Well, it reflects a couple things. Most of these governors were elected in 2010, which was a huge Republican wave election, where voters, again, they weren't electing Republicans, they were just unelecting Democrats. They were trying to say to President Obama, we don't want you controlling everything, we want to put a check, we don't like the direction the country's going. It was a much smaller turnout election. You had a disproportionate number of whites and Republicans showing up at that election, and Republicans, most governors are elected in those off years. Not this time. But Republicans actually picked up an additional governorship in North Carolina this time with Pat McCrory. I think Washington State is still out. Republicans haven't elected a governor in Washington State since 1980. It's the state that has gone the longest. And it's basically this greater Seattle area just voting straight ticket in these presidential years.
Yeah.
Presidential voting behavior is much different than off-year behavior. And what Republicans are finding in some of these cities, the avalanche of people that are coming out voting not just Democrat for president, but Democrat across the board. In Alexandria, for example, they lost two council seats. Frank Fannin had been a fixture on the council. His family had been there forever. When I talked to Alexandrians that are active in both parties, they said, Fannin's going to win, but not in a presidential turnout.
Yeah.
Because people come out of these high-rises, some of them don't even know what city they're in, but they're coming out to vote for Obama, and while they're there, see that there are council races and they vote straight across Democratic, not even familiar with the names in some cases. And that's what presidential year voting's done. It's certainly hurt the Republicans in Washington State, and one of the reasons they haven't been able to elect governors.
Right. Well, Tom, we have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking to finishing up with Tom Davis, talk a little, maybe a little procurement, Tom.
Okay.
That'd be great. But my guest today is Tom Davis, former congressman from the 11th District in Virginia and currently director of federal government affairs for Deloitte & Touche, LLP. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today my guest is Tom Davis, former congressman from the 11th District here in Virginia and currently director of federal government affairs at Deloitte & Touche, LLP. And Tom, we're going to talk a little procurement. I know you have a great interest in that area from your time working in the Fairfax County Board and also up on the Hill. One of the questions, what do you see as the biggest procurement challenges or issues if you were going to brief the incoming Congress on ways or issues that you see in procurement and things that could be improved? What would your take be?
Well, I'd say, first of all, government doesn't have a lot of money now. We're borrowing 40 cents for every dollar we spend. So if you're spending a dollar, you want to get your money's worth. And the procurement system today is not designed to get the best value for the dollar. We try to do a lot of things with the procurement system. We try to make sure that minority companies get a fair share of the procurement pie. We want to make sure small businesses get a fair share of the procurement pie. We want to make sure that we're buying American products as we procure goods. So we try to do too many things with our procurement system instead of just getting the best price. In redistributing these. And there are people who make policy arguments. This is why. But the reality is that doesn't always get you the best price. It may get some other societal goals along the way, but it doesn't necessarily guarantee you the best price. I think that as you take a look at procurement, we need to take a look at how do we get the best value for the taxpayer. That ought to be the focus of things. And to do that, you've got to, instead of prescribing 7 pages of regulations for every procurement, you've got to have a toolbox of different procurement vehicles to be used, and it's going to vary from procurement to procurement, whether you want to make it low bid, or whether you want to make it best value, whether you want to make it time and materials. There's so many different ways to go, and you have to have trained procurement officials who can decide in each case what is going to save the most money for the government. That isn't happening today. You also need some additional vehicle. I love share and savings contracts because the government will then undertake cost savings that they don't pay anything unless they save money. The risk is on the contractor. And some contractors like that, some don't, but my experience with that is that it saves a lot of money because the government is willing to undertake some programs that they otherwise would pass up on because they can't find the money in their budget to try to save other money because of arcane scoring rules and the like.
Right.
But this really starts from OMB and the White House. Office of Management and Budget likes these vehicles. They understand them. There is traditionally congressional resistance to them because Congress likes to look at all these procurements and be able to appropriate for them. And in a share and savings contract, they don't get control of that.
Right. It's a question of control there, right?
Yeah. Right. But OMB's got to take charge here and come in and say, look, we got a crisis. We're borrowing 40 cents in the dollar. We want to make sure we get a procurement. The other issues that I think OMB has to, they've got to learn to work with Republicans in the House on these issues. Bill Clinton, when he was president, was able to crack the code. A lot of legislation on procurement came through the Clinton administration. Even though they had a Democratic Congress, they really work with Republicans in the House, who I think are more willing to undergo some of these changes than Democrats because they don't have resistance from unions. They don't feel those kind of pressures and are freer to make those changes. As part of the reinventing government initiatives, you had a number of pieces of legislation that came in, Clinger Cohen, others that came through Republicans
FASA,
in the House.
Federal yeah. Activist Streamlining Act, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And there were bodies.
So now the problem has been the chairman in the House has been Darrell Issa, who has two different jobs. He's got his legislative job as chairman of the committee, which was my old committee.
Mm-hmm.
But he also has the duty to oversee and investigate when things go wrong. And the White House and Congressman Issa have got to figure out how do they find the rhythm where one day he's going to be investigating and the next day he's working with him on legislation. That's a hard thing to do. It's hard to take a punch one day and the next day be shaking hands with somebody. But, look, your professionals do it all the time. And if they can find that rhythm, I think they can have some legislative successes that they can be proud of on both sides. And they'll also find over time that it takes a little bit of the staying off some of these investigations if you have a working relationship. They found it in some areas. I know the chairman has worked well over at OPM and some of these other government agencies where the agency heads have found that rhythm. And if the White House can find that, I think we can have a very productive legislative session.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who was in government at the time that FASA and Clarence Cohen, all those things, which were bipartisan efforts, were moving through, you know, it had a profound impact on, you know, improving the efficiency from my perspective and what I saw working on contracts every day, improving the efficiency of the system. And sort of leads to my next question, because you were a big champion of commercial item contracting. It seems like there's an opportunity there for the for the House, for the White House, to work together to sort of reinvigorate commercial item contracting. I want you to get your thoughts on that.
The opportunity is there. You just have to find the rhythm between the players. As I said, it's tough. You're taking a punch one day from somebody, and you don't feel like turning the other cheek or working with them on something else. But the country's counting on these folks to work it out. The opposition always feels some responsibility to oversee the mistakes of the other party when they have that opportunity. That's not going to change. But you also have a responsibility to try to legislate and move things forward. And look, they're just going to have to find their rhythm to do that. I'm hopeful they can do that at this time, particularly because the president doesn't have to run for re-election. Traditionally, these second terms from presidents have not ended up very successful. But I think President Obama has a unique opportunity, if they could find that rhythm at this point, to take a look and work with the Republicans in the House and Democrats and Republicans in the Senate to move ahead and get some innovation in this area.
Yeah, and Tom, I have one final question for you, and it's hot stove season here, and the Nationals are, you know, Adam LaRoche is a free agent. It's a curveball on you, literally, but I just get any thoughts on where the Nationals headed? Are they going to re-sign him? What do you think they're going to do?
Well, they ought to re-sign him. You know, I think LaRoche kind of owes us a year. I mean, he only played a month his first year at his option. He's walking down a big contract and the like, and I'm hopeful that if they get together, he'll feel a certain loyalty. He certainly earned his pay this last year.
Absolutely.
And he's a fixture in the lineup. He's great defensively. So they need to work this out. The pieces of the puzzle are there for next year for the Nationals with their pitching. But LaRoche is a key component of that. He led the team in RBIs and home runs.
Yeah, there's scuttlebutt that, you know, my American League team, the Red Sox, are looking at him. But
well, the Red Sox need to look a lot.
They have a lot of holes to fill. That's absolutely
exactly
true. Tom, hey, thanks for being on the show today. Great discussion. Really appreciate it. I want to thank my guest, Tom Davis, former congressman from the 11th District in Virginia and currently director of Federal Government Affairs at Deloitte & Touche, LLP. You've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.